Shalom. Welcome to Ash JTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Bat Shlomo, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, I want to speak about Ben Hecht. We used to speak about him frequently in our movement years ago because he was a key figure in the campaign to resurrect a Jewish homeland, to create the State of Israel after 2,000 years of exile. Ben Hecht was a great Hollywood producer, playwright, director. Some of the movies that he made included Gone with the Wind, some of the greatest classics. So he was very successful. He was personally quite wealthy. And he had all the connections of all the Hollywood people and all the famous people. Even though he was an assimilated Jew and an intermarried Jew, he became outraged in the early 1940s when he learned that millions of Jews were being brutally murdered in Nazi Europe, that there was a Holocaust raging and the world was silent, and even American Jews were being silent in the face of this horrific Holocaust, this massacre of millions of innocent Jews. And he wrote a column in a newspaper in New York called PM at that time, angrily protesting this and angrily condemning the silence. Followers of Zeev Jabotinsky, who was the right-wing Zionist leader, were in the United States at the time trying to organize support for the Irgun Tzvai Leumi, which was an underground freedom-fighting organization that was fighting against British control in the land of Israel and fighting to free the land of Israel for the Jewish people. And these Irgun members, these two Irgun members, who were Jabotinsky supporters, saw the columns, the angry and very, very accurate columns that were being written by Ben Hecht. And so they went to Ben Hecht and they approached him and asked him to help the Irgun and asked him to help their campaign to create a Jewish state. And he immediately enlisted. He immediately said, yes, I support you. I agree with you. In any event, Ben Hecht tried various things to raise money and tried to do various things, but the Hollywood self-hating Jews were not interested. The wealthy Jews were not interested in the fact that millions of Jews were being murdered in Europe. It didn't interest them. And so they were not successful in raising a lot of money. But they did raise enough to save, in the end, 500,000 Jews, including the famous Raoul Wallenberg mission, where Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish diplomat in Hungary, saved thousands of Jews. Even what Raoul Wallenberg did was only made possible because of what Ben Hecht and the Jabotinsky supporters made available to Raoul Wallenberg in order to save the Jews in Hungary. In the end, about 500,000 Jews were actually saved because of the efforts of these Jabotinsky supporters, of these right-wing Jabotinsky activists, financed by Ben Hecht. But after the Holocaust, at the end of World War II in 1945, people saw the pictures of all the dead bodies and all the terrible things that had happened in the Nazi death camps. And suddenly American Jews felt guilty because they knew that they were silent and that they didn't do what could have been done to save their brothers and sisters. They knew. And so the horrifying pictures did indeed arouse certain numbers of guilty Jews who decided that they were going to finally help. And so Ben Hecht was able to raise millions of dollars for the Irgun after the Holocaust was already over. If he had raised the money before, when the Holocaust was raging, they could have saved, instead of 500,000 Jews, they might have been able to save millions of Jews. But in any event, after the Holocaust, they started raising huge amounts of money, millions of dollars. And in those days, in the 1940s, millions of dollars is a lot of money. He raised several million dollars for the Irgun. And as a result of that fundraising, the Irgun was well-financed and was able to conduct a very strong campaign to throw the British out of the land of Israel, which they did. 1,000 Irgun underground freedom fighters threw 100,000 British troops out of the land of Israel. They were outnumbered 100 to 1 by the British. And In the end, they were forced out by the Irgun. Winston Churchill himself said so in the British Parliament, and many admitted that it was the Irgun and their heroic underground campaign that forced the British out. And maybe sometime we'll speak about some of the heroic things that the Irgun did, because it's quite a story, and that's something that films should be made about. We should have movies about that instead of the garbage, the filth of the self-hating dreck that we have in Hollywood today, that make movies glorifying all of the enemies of the Jewish people. We should have movies showing true Jewish heroism, because we've had amazing, incredible Jewish heroism in our day and age. And it's never been turned into movies and turned into something where people would be able to see on the screen dramatizations of things that happened in real life, in real history. In any event, Ben Hecht financed the Irgun campaign to drive the British out. And then that same Irgun began a campaign to prevent the Arabs from destroying the Jewish community in Israel, because the Jewish community in Israel was outnumbered by the Arabs. It was unbelievable. There were 600,000 Jews in the land of Israel and 100 million Arabs surrounding the land of Israel that were promising to push the Jews into the sea. So they were outnumbered by more than 100-1. It was absolutely incredible. And the Irgun began a campaign that in the end was responsible for the victory of Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. We could go into the history of Deir Yassin and the various battles that can prove that, but I don't want to take up too much time with that right now, because I want to get back to Ben Hecht. When Ben Hecht raised millions of dollars for the Irgun, for this Jewish freedom fighting organization, for the first time in 2,000 years, Jews that were fighting for a just cause finally had real money, real backing, and a real financial opportunity to do things on a massive scale. Finally, for the first time in 20 centuries. Because before then, Jabotinsky, who was the founder of the Irgun and the founder of this movement, he couldn't even raise enough money to make a living. He had to write poems and books and do other things just to survive. He was starving. Even though he was a brilliant, charismatic speaker and leader, and thousands came to hear him speak, he didn't raise money. The Jews with money, the Jews with means, wouldn't give him and wouldn't help him. And so, you know, for some reason, this is one of the curses of right-wing Jewish movements, of real right-wing Jewish movements, the real Jewish right. We see this now with the real Kahanists. The one thing that they're unable to do is raise money for some reason, even though it's even though they are the one group that are worthy of getting support. And so when Ben Hecht finally brought in millions of dollars for the Irgun, for these Jewish underground freedom fighters, who literally blew the British out, and who literally blew the Arabs out in Deir Yassin. The victory in the Battle of Deir Yassin scared the hell out of the Arabs and psychologically turned the tide in the whole 1948 War of Independence. When Ben Hecht did this, when he gave millions of dollars to Jewish freedom fighters and Jewish heroes for the first time in 2,000 years, he created a new reality that led very quickly to the creation of a Jewish state. You see, if only the good Jews, the heroic Jews, the brave Jews, finally had the proper resources, great things could happen. Tremendous things. We have a Jewish state after 2,000 years. Millions of Jews died dreaming of. We've returned to our homeland, and the miracles of the Bible are coming alive. Look at what happens when Jews who are brave and who are heroic and who are uncompromising finally get the resources they need to do what has to be done. Now, many times, brave Jews and heroic Jews have to make do without millions of dollars. The Kahanists in the Jewish Defense League, Rabbi Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik VeKadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, our great leader, and those of us in the JDL who were fighting for Soviet Jewry, we never had millions of dollars. We never had the big resources that were needed. And we were still able to achieve miraculous results. But if we had had millions, if we had had a Ben Hecht, not only would we have freed the Soviet Jews, they would have been unable to sustain the banning of Rabbi Kahana when he ran for the Knesset. He would have gone on to run again. Or there would have been massive, well-funded protests against him not being allowed to run. And eventually, he would not have been murdered. He would have been back in the game running again. And eventually, he would have become prime minister. Can you imagine what that would have meant for the Jewish people? Rabbi Meir Kahana as prime minister of the state of Israel? Can you imagine what that would have meant for the world? Not just for the Jewish people, but for the whole world? All of that could have happened. All of that would have happened if there had been just one Ben Hecht, just one wealthy Jew with other wealthy friends who was able who would be able to put together what Ben Hecht was able to put together for the Irgun after the Holocaust in 1945, 1946, 1947. If there was just one Jew like Ben Hecht that had been able to do that for Rabbi Kahana, think of what we could have done. Think of how different the world would be today. The Messiah might have come already. Who knows what might have happened? Rabbi Kahana as prime minister? Can you imagine what that would have meant for the world? And things are still that way for the Kahanist movement. Can you imagine if JTF had millions of dollars? Can you imagine if we, with our message, could reach all the people of Israel on a regular... If we had millions of dollars, we would reach at least most of the people of Israel on a regular basis with our message. That would be enough for us. Can you imagine if we were able to do that? If the people of Israel were exposed to the facts and the logic and the information and the truth that we bring all the time? Can you imagine what that would create? First of all, we would have a political party that would be able to run in the Knesset elections and get elected. We'd get elected to the Knesset. We'd get massive attention. The media would be against us. The powerful, self-hating Jews would be against us, yes. But we would have the resources to fight back. And people would hear both sides for a change. The people of Israel would be exposed to both sides. If the people of Israel were truly exposed to both sides, who do you think would win in the end? You know that events would prove us true. People would eventually see that we're right about the Arab-Muslim-Nazi enemy, that we're right about the future of Israel. What we say would come true, and what the other side says about peace and how if we give up land, we're going to have peace, and how policies of surrender and socialism and abandoning the Torah and all this insanity, how this is going to bring about a better world, people would see eventually that that isn't true. Eventually we would win. Eventually we'd win over the hearts and souls of the people of Israel. And eventually we would take power. We'd become a mass movement and we would take power. Imagine what that would mean for the world. And so we've always wanted a Ben Hecht. We've been looking for a Ben Hecht. All these years, all my life, I'm 56 years old, all my life I'm looking for a Ben Hecht. Or I'm looking for someone who has the ability at least to do what Ben Hecht did, to raise the millions of dollars. If somebody could do that, they could save the world. And that's no exaggeration. We're the one cause. Think of what people give millions of dollars for, the nonsense, the insanity, and the terrible causes. We're the one cause. That if we had the resources, we literally could save everything. Because if we become a mass movement and we present our case to the people of Israel on a regular basis, yes, that would save Israel. That would turn the tide eventually. That would bring the final redemption. And so how we wish we could find a Ben Hecht. Now, last week I spoke to you about one of the things that we would want for the next election. We'd like to run our own Knesset list if we could get proper funding. I don't know if we can. We may not be able to by the next election. But If we could, I'd love to be able to run our own Knesset list for our movement in Israel, Hayamin HaMiti. And what we would need is, we basically need people who, they wouldn't have to actually make a, they could contribute to the campaign directly if they want to. They could make out big checks to the campaign, that's fine. But another option, in addition to that, another option is just to give us bank guarantees. If someone, let's say, guarantees, the way it works in Israel, if someone guarantees, let's say, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, gives a bank guarantee for that amount of money, if we win, if we get elected, the person making the bank guarantee does not pay a penny. The Israeli government subsidizes and finances the election of all Knesset members who win. This is an incumbent protection policy, by the way. This is the members of the Knesset did this so they could protect their seats against challengers. You have similar things, unfortunately, among incumbents in America with members of Congress, the state legislature. Incumbents always build ways to protect their own seats. And in Israel, for decades now, they've had this law where you can, all you have to do is put up a bank guarantee. You put the money up in a bank guarantee. If we win the election, if the party wins the election, then the person putting up the bank guarantee pays nothing, doesn't pay a single penny. Didn't cost a single penny. Not a single penny. It was all subsidized. It's subsidized by the Israeli government. But if we lose, then the entire amount has to be paid. Then the entire amount has to be repaid to the Israeli government, because the Israeli government is actually going to be paying for our campaign if we get a bank guarantee. What would happen is, let's say we have a, we give it, let's say we present the bank guarantee for $500,000. The Israeli government will give us $500,000 for our campaign. So the person putting up the bank guarantee then doesn't actually have to give us $500,000. The Israeli government is giving us $500,000. However, if we win, the Israeli government absorbs that cost. That's the way the law works. And the person who gave the bank guarantee doesn't pay a penny. But if we lose, God forbid, then the person putting up the bank guarantee loses the entire $500,000. Because the Israeli government will not subsidize the election if the voters did not support the party and did not elect the people running on that party. So that's how it works. So it's a gamble. We need people who are willing to make that gamble. That's one thing that we need. Now, of course, even if we don't raise enough money by election times to run a Knesset list, which is very possible, we're going to continue our campaign of trying to wake the people of Israel up and build a movement so that we could build toward the day when we will be able to run a Knesset campaign. And you know that we're the only ones telling the truth and making any sense here. Do you see anyone else in America and Israel saying what we're saying and putting together a message that truly makes sense? Do you see anyone else doing this consistently over the years? You, our great JTFers, know how important it is that we get this message across, that we reach the people of Israel, that we convince the people of Israel, that we wake the people of Israel up. You know how important this is. And if we become a mass movement in Israel, as I've said many times, I am convinced we'll also become a mass movement eventually in America. I'm convinced of that. Because if we become a mass movement in Israel, it'll be tremendous news. It'll give us tremendous publicity in the American media. American media would cover it immediately. Oh, these people, they're the ones preventing the peace process, and they're the ones pushing the settlements, and they're the ones pushing this new agenda for Torah education in Israeli schools, and they're the ones, you know, they're the ones encouraging Arabs to leave Israel. We would get tremendous attention in the American news media. And as a result of that tremendous attention that we would get, we would be able to attract a lot of people, a lot of evangelical Christians, Orthodox Jews, conservative American patriots to our movement in the United States. We'd become a mass movement in the United States as well. And then we'd be able to deal with issues that are important in the United States as well. But in the meantime, we've got to continue our campaign to try to reach as many people as possible. And therefore, once again, I appeal to all of our people out there, because I know, I don't think we have any Ben Hecks among our great JTFers. I don't think any of our great JTFers are in the same position Ben Hecht was in. If anybody is, then please help us. But there are things that every one of us can do. Every one of us can do something to make a difference. Every one of us can make a difference. Some people help us with our videos. Help promote our English and Hebrew videos when we put up videos. Promote them on YouTube. Promote them on Facebook. That's very important. Like, favorite, comment, share, mirror. Do everything you can do to promote those videos. That's very, very important. Other people help us by helping us on our forum, making our forum more interesting, more inviting. And it's very important that people not, you know, that the forum look attractive so that we attract members and so that we could become a bigger movement. That means no petty fighting on the forum. If you see petty fighting on the forum, stop it immediately. You're hurting the cause if you do that. I want to make that very clear to everybody. No petty fighting on the forum under any circumstances. Anyone who does that is hurting the cause, and it's a sin to do that. We have a lot at stake here. No petty personality feuds or other silly things. We can't afford to have that on our forum. We can have debates on our forum, but they've got to be adult debates. People who engage in petty personal attacks when they have disagreements, that's childish, and it makes us look bad. We want to have adult debates on our forum. And our JTFers are great people. You're capable of debating as like adults. And so I appeal to you to do so. That's very, very important to us. And so people can help us by posting interesting threads and posting interesting announcements on the forum. People can help us on the forum, make the forum more interesting and more attractive. People can help us on our Facebook pages. We have several Facebook pages. Very important to help us. People can come to my personal Facebook page, Chaim Ben Pesach. I have a personal Facebook page with over 1,000 likes now, which is not that big, but people can come and join. If you haven't joined, you're welcome to join my personal Facebook page. And people can join the JTF Facebook page. People should also like the Hebrew Facebook page, even if you don't understand Hebrew, like it and help us, helps us promote it. And we have still have the Romney Ryan Facebook page, which still has, I think, 700 or 800 likes and 700 or 800 people that are still members on that Facebook page. You can always go to that and help us there. So help us on Facebook, help us on the forum, help us with our videos. And yes, most of all, I want to thank the wonderful JTFers who help us financially. Because without that, we can't do anything. We always urgently need financial support to reach as many people as we can reach. Obama's going to Israel next month to pressure Israel to freeze Jewish building in Judea and Samaria. Disastrous move that endangers Israel. He's pressuring Israel, of course, not to strike at Iran, which threatens Israel's survival. It's essential that we be there to bring a message to the people of Israel now, even before the elections. We've got to do that now. And people who help us and support us are helping us with that. And so I thank the wonderful JTFers who go to JTF.org. JTF.org is our English main page. On our English main page, there's a donate button on the top. They click on the donate button, and in a couple of minutes, with their credit card, they're able to make a donation to JTF. And the same thing on Hayamin.org. We have a donate button on the top on Hayamin.org. God bless the great JTFers who help us with that. And God bless the great JTFers who, through the regular mail, some people prefer to do it with credit cards on the internet. Other people prefer to send it through the regular mail, checks, money orders, cash donations. God bless the great JTFers who help us with checks and money orders and cash donations to our post office box. God bless you, God bless your family and your loved ones in this world and in the next. Together, we got to keep fighting here, and we're going to, and eventually, God willing, we'll either find a Ben Hecht or we'll find enough Ben Hecht, several Ben Hechts. Maybe we'll have one that'll put up $100,000, for a bank guarantee. Maybe another will contribute $10,000. Another will contribute $25,000. You know, if we put together, if we piece together enough from enough people, we could do it. We could at least make the effort. Now, of course, there's no guarantee that we would win the election the first time. There's no guarantee. We're running against parties that have much more money. But I think we'd have a chance. I think we have a chance, a reasonable chance of winning. If we win, all bets are off. Then we can really accomplish big things for the Jewish people if we win. Big things. Big things. But there's no guarantee that we win. I don't know what the odds are. I don't know what the situation is going to be, but I think we'd have a chance of winning. And even if we don't win, we will have established ourselves as a party that will get attention, that will be well known, and will be able, and the next time we run, we'll be better known, and we'll have a head start, we'll have an organization ready in Israel. So no matter what, it's important for us to make the race if we could get a reasonable amount of support. Of course, if we're going to fall flat on our face, if we're just going to flop and get very few votes because we have no money and no budget, then that wouldn't be wise. But if we have a real budget and we have a chance of making a real run for it, we should definitely go for it and try. And in the meantime, we've got to keep fighting with videos and wake the people of Israel up urgently. We proved in the last election that we can influence and move votes. One of the parties, as we mentioned, Otzma Yisrael, is blaming us for their defeat. So, I mean, on their main page, they're blaming us for their defeat. They're saying because of us, because of our video campaign, exposing them. And again, we were just responding to their attacks on me personally and on us. But they claim that that's why they lost. So I think we've proven that in terms of we can negatively prevent people, we can negatively hurt parties that go against us and that try to hurt us. We have the ability to do that. We can influence things that way. The question is, can we influence things positively in terms of bringing enough voters to actually vote for us? We'd need about 80,000 votes to pass the minimum threshold, 75,000, 80,000 votes. That's a challenge. But with proper financing, we could do it. We'd have a chance at least to do it. We'd have a reasonable chance. And so that's what's at stake here. That's what's at stake here. God bless the wonderful JTFers who all these years have loyally been helping us so that we can make a difference and do our best and keep fighting until the day comes when we get a Ben Hecht, when we finally get our catch a break and are able to take off and do what has to be done for the Jewish people. God bless the great JTFers that make it possible for us to reach people and keep up this fight and keep marching forward. It's so important. I think all of you know that everything you're doing, everything you do to help us, does make a difference. It's important. It's important. And I think that God watches over us. And God, I believe God helps us when He sees good, honest, loving people helping because they want to make this a better world. I really think it makes a difference. I do. And so, again, God bless the great JTFers, and thank you for everything, and let's just hope and pray. We need your prayers. Let's just hope and help pray for us that we find a Ben Hecht and that we find the financing and that we get this breakthrough that we're looking for to make a difference for the Jewish people. Please, we need your prayers. Very, very important. Anyway, let's go now to the questions from our great JTFers, and we start off with the great Waiting for the Mother Plane to Come, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, please talk about Wallace Mohammed Fard, the white New Zealander who founded Black Islam. Also, was he really killed or did he vanish? Unquote. Well, first of all, he was killed. Of course he was killed. Many of the leaders in the Black Muslim movement have been killed. Many of them. I mean, if you look at the history, you see that they're always, not just the Black Muslims, the Black Hebrews, the Black Panthers. These organizations, they have a history of killing each other. A very high percentage of their leaders wind up being killed by their fellow members. So he was also killed. And yes, he was white, even though he pretended to be black to get black followers. He was actually white. And even though, by the way, they say that Yaqub, the evil scientist, the evil Jewish scientist Yaqub, which is Arabic for Yaakov, Jacob, because they hate Jacob. They say Yaqub, the evil Jewish scientist, is the one who invented the white race in a test tube. They say that Wallace Muhammad Fard was Allah. Yeah. They say that Allah became a person, became a human being, and created the black Muslim movement. And then Elijah, and then Allah decided to become Elijah Muhammad. In other words, each one that dies and disappears, Allah decides to appear in the next one, the next leader that comes forward. Just unbelievable insanity. By the way, they insist that Wallace Muhammad Fard is still alive. This is a guy who was born 120 years ago or something like that. They claim he's still alive. They claim he never died, that he's in the mothership. There's a mothership flying over the United States, that Allah's flying over the United States. When Allah gives the signal, the mothership is going to suck up the whole white race and exterminate the whole white race. This is what they teach. In the meantime, the leaders of their cult are Allah incarnate. And so these are the people who hold rallies that Barack Hussein Obama attends, that members of the Congressional Black Caucus attend, that Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton attend, all the leaders of the black community support these people. I mean, look at what we're dealing with. Look at what we're dealing with, what lunacy we're dealing with. Anyway, thank you so much, waiting for the mother plane to come. And now we go to another great JTFer, Pyramid Head Fan, who writes, and I quote, "Why do we even have embassies in Muslim countries if they hate our guts?" Unquote. That's a great question. And the answer is we shouldn't. We shouldn't. We should have nothing to do with them. And we certainly shouldn't be subsidizing them with hundreds of billions of dollars that we pay for their oil and tens of billions of dollars in foreign aid. And hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons sales to these Muslim terrorist countries. Of course, it's insanity. It's madness. But people make profit dealing with them, dealing with the petro-rich Muslim countries. And so they have an incentive to continue this, even though it's bad for America, bad for Israel, bad for the Western world, and bad for any decent person that we have relations with Muslim countries that want to destroy us. Anyway, thank you for making a great point. And now we go to ex-Muslim, who has been making some very, very good points on our forum. Ex-Muslim writes, and I quote, "In Mali, Francois Hollande was received by hundreds of thousands of grateful Malians waving the French flag. Are Muslims becoming more pro-West?" Unquote. No, of course not. No, of course not. The French support one of the Muslim factions against the other Muslim faction. And so the Muslim faction that the French support came out and cheered the French leader when he came to visit. I mean, there are people in Mali who don't want the other Islamic faction to win because the other Islamic faction is going to oppress them. There are Muslims who want personal freedom, who don't want to be oppressed, who don't want to be smothered by Islamic fundamentalism. There are Muslims that don't want to be smothered by Islamic fundamentalism. But even among those groups, unfortunately, there is still a hatred toward the West and an envy toward the West. I remember when the Israelis went into Lebanon and liberated Lebanon, that there were Muslims. Thousands of Muslims came out cheering the Israelis when they liberated Lebanon. But those same Muslims who cheered the Israelis, a week later, were murdering them. Were murdering the Israeli soldiers. So let's not be fooled by this. Let's not be fooled by this. The people waving the French flag are not pro-West. They just are members of one Muslim faction that's supported by France right now. And so they're going to do whatever they can do to continue to get that support. Anyway, thank you, ex-Muslim. And now we go to the great Chicago Jew who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is your opinion of Barack Hussein Osama finally visiting Israel, unquote. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. He's going to Israel to tell Israel to freeze Jewish building in Judea and Samaria, which is a catastrophe for the state of Israel. Everything we warned about is coming true. I mean, look at how quickly he's going to Israel right after the Israeli elections. Look how quickly he's starting. Remember, we said this was going to happen. We warned that we were going to have 4 years of relentless pressure on Israel and danger toward Israel from this Muslim Jew hater. And we see it coming true. Look at what he's doing with Iran. He's holding Israel back from defending herself all this time with Iran. Things would have been a lot better if he had been defeated. But we have to deal with him, and we've got to try to reach as many Israelis as possible and tell the people of Israel that Israel should not give in to him. Israel should ignore Barack Hussein Osama's pressure and should do what Israel should do what she has to do to survive. Anyway, thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to Super Mentalita, who has been making very, very interesting posts and has been a great contributor to the JTF forum. Super Mentalita writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, please tell the people something more about the situation in Europe and about the attack on Lars Hedegaard today. Thank you, unquote. Yes, it's unbelievable that Lars Hedegaard is someone that very few Americans know about. Very few Americans have heard of Lars Hedegaard. He is a Danish writer who tells the truth about Islam. He's critical of Islam and he tells the truth about Islam. Someone came to his door, a Muslim terrorist, pretended he was making a delivery, went to his apartment in Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark, knocked on his door and pretended he was making a delivery. So Lars opened the door, and this Muslim terrorist then pulled out a gun and shot at Lars. He missed Lars, fortunately. Lars moved and he missed him, but the bullet was very close. Just when Lars said that the bullet was literally went like right past his ear. It was very, very close to him. He almost got hit by it. Lars is 70 years old, but Lars punched the Muslim terrorist in the face. The Muslim terrorist, by the way, is 20 to 25 years old. Lars is 70 years old, but Lars punched the Muslim terrorist in the face, and the Muslim terrorist dropped the gun and ran away. But still, I think this is an indication of how dangerous the situation is. People are not allowed to express themselves and tell the truth about Islam. We have a situation where Muslims are violently dictating to us what we're allowed and not allowed to say. And that's really creating an environment where Muslims, in effect, are going to be controlling our lives. Through violence and through their petrodollars, they're going to be controlling our lives. That's already happening in many European countries. Anyway, thank you, Super Mentalita. And now we get a question from the great Christians for Jews, who writes, and I quote, what is your opinion on IQ tests? Are they an accurate indication of someone's intelligence? Unquote. I think that you can get a lot of accurate information about someone's intelligence from an IQ test. I do think IQ tests are useful. They're not absolute. Are there instances where someone doesn't do well on an IQ test, but they're still very talented and intelligent? Of course, there are exceptions. But generally speaking, I think that they are a pretty good indication. And they can provide useful information in measuring someone's intelligence or ability. I do think they can provide useful information. Anyway, thank you, Christians for Jews. And now we go to the fantastic Say No to Islam. Say No to Islam writes, and I quote, please comment on 1. Persecution of ethnic Russians in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, unquote. Well, there's always been a tremendous amount of tension and violence between Russians and the Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, the Baltic states, the three Baltic states, because Russia occupied these three countries, of course, for many years. The Soviet Union occupied Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. During World War II, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia fought together with Nazi Germany against the Soviets, against Russia. By the way, they murdered the Jews in the Baltic states. The Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians were Nazis who murdered the Jews living in those countries. And so there's a long, long history of hatred and violence and fear and suspicion between the Russians and between the majority population in these Baltic states. And that's something that you're going to continue to see. You're going to continue to see a very tense relationship between these three Baltic countries and Russia. Now, Say No to Islam writes, 2, the political situation in Belarus, unquote. Okay, Belarus, you know, let me clarify some of this stuff, because a lot of Americans know very little about geography and history. It's just not something that's taught, unfortunately, in the school system. We're too busy learning about Black History Month and about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. You know, we don't learn about the history of nations that really influenced the world and that really had an impact on the world. Belarus is a nation of about 9.5 million people. It is a former Soviet republic, and it borders on Russia. And it borders on Russia, the Ukraine, the Baltic states. Belarus was once 10% Jewish. 10% of the population in Belarus was once Jewish. So for the Jewish people, Belarus used to be an important nation, an important area. Anyway, today it's an independent nation, supposedly, with 9.5 million people, but it's not really independent. It's become a puppet of Russia. You have so-called elections there that are a farce, just like the elections in Russia are a farce. Vladimir Putin controls the elections in Russia and oppresses anyone who dares to go against him. He's a dictator, and you have the same thing in Belarus. They have the same exact model. They do exactly what Putin does in Russia. And in Belarus, they have a policy that is dictated to by Russia. So they're basically a puppet of Vladimir Putin and Russia. Anyway, thank you, Say No to Islam. And now we go to Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, did Perez get Israel the atom bomb? Should we praise him for it? Unquote. No, he did not get Israel the atom bomb. He was one of the leaders of Israel who, as an assistant defense minister, worked on getting government support for the project. But the claim that he got the atom bomb for Israel is absurd. He, you know, this animal, this vicious, egotistical, despicable, self-hating piece of garbage, Shimon Peres, always takes credit for everything. All he has done is destructive things for the Jewish people and the Jewish state. And he's trying to destroy Israel. When he was prime minister, he proposed that Israel join the Arab League and become an Arab nation. Literally. I mean, he is such a destructive, self-hating traitor. He is the ultimate. If you want to look up self-hating Jew in the dictionary, you'll see his picture there. Thousands of Jewish lives were lost because of this animal, because of all the things he did in the Oslo agreements and all the terrible things he did. You know that when Israel did acquire the atom bomb, the first thing he wanted to do was give the knowledge of an atom bomb over to Iran, because Iran, with the Shah in those days, was supposedly an ally of Israel. So Shimon Peres said, let's give them the atom bomb. Let's give them the atomic secrets and build an atomic nuclear plant for them in Iran. Can you imagine if Israel had done that? This was in the 1960s. If Israel had done that now, after the Ayatollahs had taken over? Can you imagine what that would have led to? I mean, he's a disaster. He doesn't deserve credit for anything. When someone is responsible for murdering Jews, and when someone betrays the Jewish people, even if they do something positive in the past, if they did something positive in the past, you could be sure that he did it for his own egotistical reasons and his own evil reasons, and he deserves no credit. Someone who has Jewish blood on his hands should never get... We should not be... You know, Rabbi Kahana used to say, we Jews have the disease of objectivity. With Jews, it's always on the one hand, but then again on the other hand, this is a sickness. This is a Jewish mental illness. It's called it's the sickness of objectivity. We should not be objective all the time. Not when it comes to Jewish survival. When someone's a traitor, they're a traitor. If they did something in the past in order to advance their careers or whatever their reasons were, you don't give them credit. You never give an inch. You never give credit to evil people that are endangering your survival. Never. He deserves no credit. Anyway, Tag Mechir now writes, and I quote, "Should Haredi children be compelled to get a broad education, math, English, etc.?" The one thing that we, in our platform, the party that we'd like to create in Israel and our movement in Israel, the one thing we call for in our platform is, in terms of education, is Torah education. We do not want to compel children to have to learn English. Why should an Israeli Jewish kid have to learn English if his parents don't want him to? If his parents want him to study Torah and want him to study in the yeshiva and don't want him learning English, that's their right. He has to learn English. He has to know what we think he has to know. Who says who? No, I as long as they're Jewish values and they're being brought up as good Jews, I don't think you have to learn. I don't think you have to learn English. Do I think if I had children, would I want them to learn English in Israel? Yes, I would, because I think that it's useful in terms of making a living, in terms of knowing computers and making a living and being tuned into the world and being able to influence things better in the world. But I could see the other side. There are people who feel that's not necessary, that there are other ways to have an impact on the world if you're an Israeli Jew living in Israel and you speak Hebrew and you don't think English is necessary. So the one thing that we do want to introduce into the education system is Torah. We would make studying of the Torah one of the subjects that children have to learn in school, including non-religious schools. Every Jewish child would have to learn what the Torah is and would have to learn about the commandments and learn about the mitzvot. They would have to learn. And they'd have to be taught by someone who is a believer, who believes. Every Jewish child would have to learn that. That doesn't mean we're going to force people to observe the mitzvot. We're not going to force people to observe Shabbat and to observe Shabbat is the Sabbath and to observe Kashrut. Kashrut are the kosher dietary laws. We're not going to force people to observe the commandments. We're not going to do that. People will be free to observe them or not to observe them. You know, I urge Jews to observe them. And it hurts me when Jews don't. But if Jews choose not to, you know, we're not going to put a gun to their head and say you have to do what we tell you to do when it comes to this. But in school, if you want to get a diploma, you've got to learn certain subjects now. You've got to learn math, you've got to learn computers, you've got to learn history, you've got to learn certain subjects to get a diploma in Israel. We're saying one of those subjects should be the Torah. Jewish kids should have to know the Torah. It's just as important as any other subject. In fact, it's more important, but it's certainly as important as every other subject. That is the one thing we would introduce into the Israeli educational system. Not to force people to observe the Torah, but just so they should know. We want everybody to at least know what it is they're accepting or rejecting. Anyway, thank you very much, Tag Mechir. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, "Talk about Irv Rubin before, during, and after his JDL days," unquote. Well, before his day, I don't know, I didn't know Irv Rubin before he was in JDL. I don't know that much about him before he was in JDL. But when he was in JDL, he was a disaster. He divided the movement and was against Rabbi Kahana. He was not a Kahanist. He was very much against Rabbi Kahana, condemned Rabbi Kahana repeatedly. He condemned what we were doing to save Soviet Jews. He called me a terrorist. He called me a terrorist for damaging the property of Soviet diplomats in order to free Soviet Jews. Meanwhile, in the end, he was arrested for trying to blow people up in their offices. He wanted to blow people up in their offices and went and was arrested and was facing 20 years in prison and then committed suicide in prison when he was facing the prison time. And he called me a terrorist? I mean, what he wanted to do was just downright stupid. What I did was, I think, was very important for the sake of justice and to save the Jewish people. He called that terrorism. Anyway, he was not a good person. Unfortunately, he was not a good person. And he did terrible things. And in the end, you know, he tragically took his own life in the end. His co-defendant in that case, Earl Krugel, was killed 4 days after he entered the prison system. His co-defendant, you can look it up, by the way, on the internet, his co-defendant openly promised to become an informer for the FBI. That was part of his plea deal. He agreed to become an informer, and he still got 20 years in prison because this is post-9/11. Post-9/11, they gave out huge sentences for this. I mean, this was so dumb what they did. They didn't actually do anything. They spoke to an FBI, to someone who had a wire on. The FBI had a wire on them. And they proposed doing things, blowing up the offices of a congressman. They proposed doing these things. And so they got, of course, with the tape, with the wire and their own voice, you know, they had no chance of winning in a trial. And I mean, it was just so dumb. It was like everything that they did, just so dumb. And so, what can I say? And by the way, the fact that his co-defendant, Earl Krugel, was killed 4 days after, he only lasted 4 days in prison, his co-defendant, Earl Krugel, 4 days after he arrived at the prison in Arizona. A neo-Nazi inmate took a big block and threw it on his head and crushed his skull and killed him. 4 days into his sentence. I was in the prison system for 5.5 years. So you can imagine, I mean, the prison system is very dangerous. It's a very dangerous place for Jews, especially for Jews in prominent Jewish cases. It could be a very dangerous place. It's a miracle. I just want people to know what a miracle it is. I mean, 5.5 years I was in the prison system, that was a miracle. But Irv and his co-defendant and the people he had out there, I mean, they did some really, really terrible things to Rabbi Kahana. They did terrible things to me. Just terrible, terrible things, unfortunately. And what can I say? I mean, the consequences of those actions were harmful to the movement. Dr. Dan now writes, also your comments, there is no such thing as superior race, only superior morality, unquote. Well, you know, I do think there may be differences between races on certain characteristics of certain races. I do not believe in the concept of racial supremacy or racial inferiority, genetic supremacy and genetic inferiority. I don't preach that type of message. God did create all of the different races. But I do think that there's a possibility that certain people have a tendency to be more talented in certain areas, and certain people have a tendency to be less talented in certain areas. That may be related, some of that may be related to genetics, and some of it may be related to environment and to culture. But in general, we do not blanketly say an entire race is inferior. And we believe in racial supremacy. We do not say that. We do believe that there are cultures that are superior to other cultures. For instance, I do believe Western culture is superior to Muslim culture. I think the culture in the Muslim world is inferior, grossly inferior. And I think that the culture in the Western world is superior to the Muslim culture. I think for the Jewish people, Jews have to have a Torah culture, a special Torah culture. They have to live Torah Jewish lives. So I do believe that there are differences in terms of culture, but that's something that is not related necessarily to genes or to heredity. Those are things that may be related to choices people make and to free will and to morals. Anyway, thank you, Dr. Dan. Great questions as always. Dr. Dan always asks important questions and very deep questions. And now, let me just see where we are. Oh, here we go. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "Please discuss your thoughts about the murder in Turkey of Saray Sierra. She was the 33-year-old mother of two from Staten Island in the news," unquote. It's a weird, tragic story, EB. Apparently, she went to Turkey to have affairs with men. She was married, but she was having affairs with men. She slept with at least two men, according to the police. She slept with at least two men there. In fact, they say in Turkey that one of the men, she had sex with him in the bathroom of a bar. She went to the bathroom of a bar to have sexual relations with a man. And then the other case, she flew from Turkey to Amsterdam to have sex with a man, and then flew back to Turkey, and then finally in Turkey she was murdered. I mean, just, you know, what a crazy story. Obviously, there are moral issues involved here, but I think one of the morals of the story is don't travel to Turkey and Muslim countries. Do not go to Muslim countries. Millions of Jews have visited Turkey. You know how many tourist dollars the Turks have gotten from the Jews, and they hate the Jewish people. They're so filled with hatred for the Jewish people. And you know the unbelievable amount of tourist money that they've gotten from Israeli Jews, American Jews that go traveling to Istanbul and Ankara and all these other places in Turkey. I mean, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. If you want to go traveling, you spend your tourist money in the land of Israel. Never, never give money for tourism in Muslim countries. Anyway, thank you, EB. And now we go to our great friend British Sword, who writes, and I quote, "What is freedom?" unquote. Okay, interesting question, British Sword. Freedom, my definition of freedom, is total subservience to the will of God. If you're going to ask me, that's my definition. You know, we have a saying in Hebrew. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, was referred to as Eved Hashem. Eved Hashem means a slave of God. Now, does that mean he was free? A slave of God is free? How, you know, and that's considered to be a symbol of freedom in Judaism, to be a slave of God. Why? Because a slave of God is not like a slave to a human master. A human master exploits the slave, controls the slave. A slave of God is a slave to a master who only wants the very best for the slave. God gains nothing from our relationship with him. You can't do anything for God. God is absolutely perfect. God has everything, is all-powerful. There is nothing we can do for God. It's impossible to do anything for God. God is unchangeable. And so, whatever we do supposedly for God, when we praise God or pray to God, whatever we do for God, supposedly, we're really doing for ourselves. We're not doing anything for God. We're doing it for ourselves. When we praise God, it's so that we will understand how great God is and how merciful and kind God is. When we pray to God, of course, it's for ourselves. When we express our gratitude toward God, this is for ourselves, because we should understand how great God is. True freedom is to understand that God controls the world, to understand what's really important in life, and to believe, and to free oneself from bad habits, and to have a life of discipline and a life of commitment to making this a better world. That's true freedom. That is true freedom. it's my definition of freedom anyway. Anyway, thank you, British Sword. And now we go to the fantastic Gimatria, who writes, and I quote, "Hi, Chaim. David Ben Moshe spoke about working for an oil company. Did this ever cause friction between you?" Unquote. No, absolutely not. First of all, when David worked for an oil company, that's before he knew me. I know David for about 13 years. He worked for the oil company years before he met me. He met me about 13 years ago. But no, no. David later on learned how evil the oil company is. He didn't know at the time when he didn't know. He thought the oil company, they're getting oil, they're getting energy. We need oil. We need oil for the economy. He didn't know. He didn't realize what was going on. So no, of course not. Of course not. David is a very righteous person, as you know, Gimatria, a very fine person. Always has the best of intentions. And now Gimatria writes, and I quote, "Who will succeed the Gamad Bloomberg?" Unquote. Gamad, by the way, means midget. Unfortunately, I think Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, is probably going to be succeeded by Christine Quinn. I think she's probably going to win. Christine Quinn is the city council speaker in New York. She's an extreme left-wing Democrat. She's also a lesbian, an open lesbian who says that she's married to another woman. So you can imagine, what a curse this is for the people of New York. God, of course, does not approve at all of this. And saying that this is marriage and electing somebody like this, that's a pretty bad... pretty bad curse on the city of New York. But I think that Christine Quinn is the front runner. I think she's the favorite. I hope she doesn't win because I think she's terrible. But she, in my opinion, she is the favorite to win the Democrat nomination. And I think she would be the favorite to win in November. Anyway, thank you, Gimatria. And now we go to the fantastic Kahana Loyalist. It's always great to see Kahana Loyalist. Kahana Loyalist writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, could we hear a Rabbi Kahana story?" Unquote. Yes. This is a story that I don't think I've ever told. In 1978, Rabbi Kahana brought an Arab to the United States from Israel, an Israeli Arab to the United States. This was an Israeli Arab who wanted to be part of Rabbi Kahana's plan to leave Israel. Rabbi Kahana had a plan to help the Arabs leave Israel, to encourage them to leave and to get them out. And this was one of the Arabs that he met. He met many Arabs in Israel that were interested in this. And one of the Arabs that he met was willing to come to the United States and speak about this, but he didn't want to show his face because he was afraid he was going to be assassinated. But this was a real Arab Muslim who wanted to leave Israel with his family permanently. And he came, and I had to take care of this Arab because the problem was the Arab didn't speak English. He spoke Arabic and Hebrew because he was born in Israel. He spoke Hebrew as well. So he spoke Arabic and Hebrew, and I was the only one in the movement at that time in the United States who spoke Hebrew fluently. So, you know, I had to pretty much take care of the Arab because no one else could take care of him because he knew virtually no English. Anyway, and you know, we kept him and we took him around, and Rabbi Kahana had him in a hotel in the 20s, in the East 20s in Manhattan. He put him in one of these hotels, and then we flew him out to Los Angeles and Chicago and elsewhere in Philadelphia, and Miami. We had him on television. We held press conferences and we did interviews with him, and we was on radio shows, and you know, we were translating what he was saying. And we got quite a bit of attention for the fact that, and even the Israeli media covered the fact that people in the United States were interested in what Rabbi Kahana was saying, because the Israeli media was trying to boycott this story. They were refusing to cover the story. But when Rabbi Kahana brought him to New York, ironically, the same Israeli media, they wouldn't cover this when Rabbi Kahana wanted to wanted to publicize this in Israel. When it was in New York, the Israeli media, the journal, Israeli journalists in New York covered the story that Rabbi Kahana is bringing this Arab all around the United States. He's bringing him to New York and Washington and Boston and all these other, and Philadelphia. And all these Americans are interested, American Jews and American evangelical Christians and other Americans are interested in helping to get the Arabs out of Israel. You know, this became a story in Israel. So it actually was a pretty successful, it was actually a pretty smart, successful move that the rabbi made. It was one of the clever public relations moves that the rabbi made in order to advance his agenda of convincing the people of Israel that we should encourage the Arabs to leave. Oh, it seems like yesterday. It seems like yesterday. And that's 1978 we're talking about. 1978, that's, let's see, 1978, that's 35 years ago. Wow, already 35 years. Kahana Loyalist now writes, and I quote, "Also, have you had any luck raising the money for a Knesset run?" Unquote. Not yet, not really anything special, but we just started. We've just started, and hopefully, you know, I hope we'll get enough money for it. If we don't, then we got to keep pushing until the next election after that. I mean, I hope that doesn't happen, but you know, we just started, and I hope we're gonna be able to do it. Anyway, thank you, Kahana Loyalist, and now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, do you believe that when Obama visits Israel, he will speak before the Knesset like Sadat did in 1977, unquote. I don't know. I don't know if he's going to go before the Knesset. The latest thing that I've seen in the Israeli media is that he actually wants to speak at a university like he did in Egypt. He wants to speak to the people of Israel directly and urge the people of Israel to commit suicide. Because that's what he's going to do. He's going to tell them you have to have a Palestinian state and you have to retreat to the pre-1967 suicide borders, because that's his plan. He won't say pre-67 borders, but he'll say you have to have a Palestinian state and you've got to make concessions and for peace it's the best thing for Israel. And he's going to give the whole spiel that his self-hating Jewish advisors are going to write for him. And the Israeli media, of course, are going to say, oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, this is a brilliant vision. This is what we need. You know, so far that seems to be the plan, that he's planning to speak at a university or somehow directly address the people of Israel. Considering how empty-headed so many Jews are in our generation, that's always dangerous when something like that happens. So we've got to be there, and we've got to be there to fight back. We've got to be there to fight back and to tell the people of Israel, this is a Muslim Jew hater who wants you dead. He wants the people of Israel dead, God forbid. And that's not an exaggeration. Anyway, thank you, Maimonides. And I want to thank all the great JTFers for the great questions this week and for everything else. And until next week, Shalom.